This is the Big E Sports Show on SB Nation Radio.
Final seconds. It's over. It's over. Cleveland is a city of champions once again. The Cavaliers are NBA champions.
Here's your host, 6'1", former Oklahoma Sooner basketball player, Alyssa Walker Campbell.
Hey, welcome back to SB Nation Radio, the Big E Sports Show. I am Alyssa Walker Campbell, and we always deliver the biggest and the very best in sports. So in our next segment, it is time to go inside the ropes with PGA professional and author, the great Larry Miller. Mr. Miller joins us each and every week right here on our network at the next generation of sports radio. Good evening, Larry. Has it been a good week?
Good evening again. It's been a great week, except for the rain here in the deep south.
Well, it's been a great week for me personally, because how about the Oklahoma Sooner, the men's golf team, getting their second title against Oregon? That was fantastic to watch. What were your takeaways?
Well, there must be something in the water in Oklahoma because, not just the Sooners, but Oklahoma State is a perennial powerhouse.
That's
in
true.
Golf. I almost went there on a college golf scholarship. I had an offer. Ended up staying in New Orleans. But like I said, something in the water in Oklahoma. Tons of good players coming out of there all the time.
Yeah, and the last title that they had won was in 1989. I was actually at OU at that time. But, I want to ask you, you played college golf for Loyola New Orleans, and you were captain for all 4 years, and you only lost one singles match in 4 seasons. What was that like? What was your college experience like? And I have to wonder, too, Larry, how much the college experience as a golfer has changed throughout the years.
Yeah, well, regarding my career, it's pretty interesting. At the time, Mac McClendon played for LSU. Mac went on to play the tour also, and he actually won a few tournaments. And famously, he lost to one of Arnold Palmer's famous charges. Mac had a three-shot lead with three holes to go at Jackie Gleason's tournament in Fort Lauderdale.
Okay.
And he was the victim of Palmer's three birdies on 16, 17, and 18, and then the first hole of a playoff.
So anyway,
the interesting part is that we would play LSU every year, our team, Loyola would, and Mac had never lost a singles match at his home course in Baton Rouge, and I hadn't lost at my home course in New Orleans. So that season, it was my junior year, that particular season, I beat him on his course in Baton Rouge, and he beat me on my course in New Orleans,
and it's the only
singles match either one of us lost in school, which was really interesting story. But college golf, it's changed so much. I mean, back when I played, you had basically one or two, the number one and number two, maybe number three guy, were good players. And then they would fill it in to have a team. But now you've got great players that can't even make the starting team. That's how strong the number of good, the parity has become, and the number of good players at a young age. It's changed dramatically. And not only that, but now they play so many tournaments in college that when they turn pro, they are tournament tough. They're tested. They're almost veterans already. They've played so much competitive golf. So it's changed dramatically along, of course, with the equipment changes and all that. But it's quite different now. But it was fun back then. It was great fun. And it really kick-started my career.
And, today's competitive college golfer, they've got an entourage by the time they sign with the university. They've got a swing coach. They've, got a mental coach. There's so many components for these guys and gals to be able to go out there and execute on the course. There's just a lot of equity built up from a lot of different folks. It's not just the head coach of the university.
Oh, yeah. You hear now, it's a team now. It's literally a team. You hear Jordan Spieth all the time say, we did this.
That's right.
We're playing well. That's how they think, because you're right. They have an entourage of support. They have, they have a trainer. They have their caddy, a coach, swing coach. Most of them even have accountants and attorneys following them around.
That's true.
It's a big business now.
Larry Miller is back with us at SB Nation Radio, the Big E Sports Show, as we are inside the ropes. Hey, celebrating Oklahoma, the Sooners, their second national title, talking about their golf program. And, you know, we had just even mentioned just how much golf, collegiate-wise, it has changed. It has evolved over the years. And I think a big component that we haven't hit on is how fitness has changed the game of golf and the focus on conditioning. Can you kind of speak to that, Larry?
Absolutely. And it's one reason that the you know, they're hitting the ball so much farther. The equipment changes, but also the conditioning of the players. You know, back when I played college golf, hardly anybody worked out with weights. I mean, the belief then was that if you worked out with weights, it would get you your muscles tight and bulk you up, and that was not good. You wanted more, you know, more flexibility, more fluidity in your swing, and that if you lifted too many weights, you'd bulk up and get tight, especially up in the shoulder area. But now, they monitor it now, the trainers do, so well and so closely and so specifically that they're able to target the golf muscles that are used in the swing and strengthen those muscles and the speed of those muscles without getting the tightness in the body. So, yeah, I mean, it's become a science it is a science, the conditioning. And it's just one, you know, contributing reason to the prodigious distances that these kids are hitting the ball now. You know, the longest hitters, I talked to a couple of tour players about this, and the question was, who hits the ball longest, the PGA Tour, the web.com, college, or high school?
Mm-hmm.
And you'd be amazed. It's high school and college that hit it the farthest now.
Really?
And the other element is just simply human evolution. You know, kids are getting bigger and stronger, and the average tour player now looks like a defensive back in the NFL.
Yeah.
You know, 6'1", 180. You know, back when I played, everybody was, you know, 5'10", 5'9", 5'11", 160, 70 pounds. And the athlete has just changed. It's partly human evolution, partly conditioning, and partly equipment. And so now you're seeing, you know, drives carry 320 and 30 yards as opposed to back then, 280 was a long drive.
Well, that standout player for Oklahoma, Brad Dahlke, his father won a national championship under Barry Switzer. And if you look at Brad Dahlke's, just his physique, I mean, he looks like a football player. He doesn't look like your typical golfer.
Yeah.
But I know you and I, we had talked earlier about just the conditioning, the training. Even, you know, you encouraged me to, hey, Google Dustin Johnson. I mean, what his conditioning, what all he goes through to get his game to where it needs to be. Would you share a little bit of that with our listeners tonight?
Dustin Johnson he's probably the best conditioned athlete on the tour, and he can do remarkable things. I think I mentioned this once before. I saw a video of him jumping out of a pool from 4 feet of water onto the side of the pool. Try that with no water. You can't even do it with no water. He can do it with 4 feet of water.
Mm.
And so, but I will say this. I would caution all the young players out there and the parents of young players, if they're going to embark on a weight training program, to make sure that they get a really competent, credible coach to train them in the weight training and in the conditioning that they do, because you definitely want to do it right, because you want to strengthen the specific muscles for the golf swing. You don't want to just randomly bulk up your body, because it can be a detriment to the golf swing. So,
and you certainly don't
want to.
Yeah, and you don't want to. Excuse me. You don't want to jack up your back either, right?
Exactly. Exactly. And yeah, it, as we've seen with some players. But anyway, very important. So be careful with that, and pick a really good trainer.
He is back with us, Larry Miller, as we are inside the ropes tonight at SB Nation Radio, the Big E Sports Show. Hey, we love our listeners, and we especially love hearing from you. Join us social media. That's right, Twitter at eRadio Sports, and go back to our amazing podcast page right here at our network. They do it so well, podcastarena.com, not just the Big E Sports Show, but all of our amazing shows and hosts right here. Okay, so I want to talk some more about, you know, equipment, golf clubs, how it has changed over time. Certainly the golf drivers have changed the game forever. It has improved. Technology, Larry, has revolutionized the tools of the sport and the design of production clubs. It has become a science. And kids these days, I mean, they are fascinated with it. I mean, my little Eli, he had to have that new Callaway Epic driver.
Well, yeah, it just keeps going on and on. There's no end to human creativity. You know, just when you think they've thought of everything, they come up with something else. And then through materials or combinations of materials or design. They just keep finding ways to make the ball go farther, even though there are restrictions on the initial velocity of the ball. And, you know, they try to govern the and control the distance, but they just can't because of the human creativity involved.
We are Inside the Ropes with PGA professional and author Larry Miller tonight at SB Nation Radio, the Big E Sports Show. Going to step aside for a quick commercial break, and we will be right back.
This is the Big E Sports Show on SB Nation Radio. Here's your host, Alyssa Walker-Campbell.
Welcome inside the ropes with Larry Miller at SB Nation Radio, the Big E Sports Show. We are going to continue our conversation with our PGA news and notes. And, you know, one of the storylines that we have to get into, it's very unfortunate, is Tiger Woods. What was your reaction when you heard the video or saw the video and this all played out this week?
My reaction was sadness.
Yes.
You know, what you're seeing is you're seeing a great example of the trappings of fame and fortune, what can happen. Tiger Woods probably has some measure of depression because of his, inability to play competitively. And so he's resorting to escape in various ways. And it's really sad. It's a sad thing because he was so great for the game. He made a huge difference. And he's the last person to dominate the PGA Tour. And it may never be dominated again. Nicklaus did it. Tiger Woods did it. For a time, Greg Norman did. And for a short time, Johnny Miller and even Arnold Palmer. But today, you've got so many players. You've got so many superstars, so to speak, that every given week, who's ever on is going to win. I think the only way you're going to see a dominant figure again is if you see one of these national long drive champions who can drive at 420 yards. If one of these guys comes along who also is a good iron player, has a good short game, and is a good putter, then you might see someone dominate the game again. But until that happens, you're not going to see it because you've got 8 or 10 superstars now. But Tiger Woods, you know, I would love to see him at least first of all, get his life in order through a support group, his core support group, whoever, and try to get him on the right path personally. The golf game, in my opinion, it's never going to be what it was. It would take a medical miracle for him to play at the level that he played on back in those years where he dominated. It would take just literally a medical miracle. It's not going to happen. The best he could ever hope for would be just to compete again on the tour level. I don't think you'll see him win. I just don't think you'll see him win again. His body is just too racked from the surgeries and the injuries. But first of all, it's his personal life. He has to get in order. Until that happens, nothing else good is going to happen.
Right.
And I just think I just did feel sadness for him. I feel bad for him because I think when he lost his father, I think he's been a lost soul ever since then, and he's resorted to all sorts of escapism mechanisms.
I was going to say, what advice would you give him? Because Jack Nicklaus came out and seemed to imply that the golf world needs to rally around him, provide support, and he wasn't saying to make an exception for Tiger Woods, that but to help him, as you were talking about, get healthy on the inside, get his personal life together, and he's a father. He's got to be an example for his kids.
That's right. He needs to humble himself, and let people help him. And I really think he wants help too. They always say that a person can't get helped until they want to be helped, and I really think he wants to be helped, but I don't know if he's allowed enough people or any people in close enough to his heart.
That's true.
To be able to humble himself and be advised on that level, and I think that's what he needs. And I hope that somebody can get through, and that he will trust someone enough to let them help him.
Some great insight and perspective from Larry Miller as we are Inside the Ropes. Larry joins us each and every week right here at SB Nation Radio, the Big E Sports Show. Okay, let's shift gears here. Let's get a little bit of a recap from the historic Colonial Tournament taking place in Fort Worth last weekend. How about, you know, we talked about this on the show last week, Larry, Jordan Spieth. I mean, a very nice bounce back at the Colonial. What did we learn about his performance? Because he put up a tremendous fight.
He's in and out.
You can't count him out?
I've said this on some of the other shows.
Yeah.
There's a pattern. There's a pattern where he will play really well, and then he'll just go the opposite way for a while. And then all of a sudden he's back and he's in, you know, either winning or in contention. I don't know. I think I always go back to the fact that if a player relies on timing in his golf swing and in swing adjustments for flaws, that once you rely on timing, you're not going to be consistent. You're going to have periods of inconsistency when your timing is just a little bit off. I think that's what's happening with Jordan. Now, his ball striking has been better this year, but his putting has failed a little bit, by his standards. But he got it together and putted well and played well at Colonial. So I think that he needs to address his golf swing a little bit. And don't get me wrong, it's a great golf swing. It produces great golf shots, but it does rely on timing. He has a couple of things in his swing that he has to adjust for as he swings, in swing adjustments, if you will. And he's very good at doing it, great eye-hand coordination. But every now and then, the timing's just a bit off. And I'll tell you, on the PGA Tour, all it takes is a bit off, and you're down the road slamming the trunk. So
nice.
You've got to be very mechanically sound as you can get, and then have a great short game.
You know, you mentioned his golf swing, but we had talked about this as well, that, you know, he showed up at the Byron Nelson with his new mallet putter. And typically, I mean, tell us, you know, from your personal point of view, how long does it take to make that kind of transition? I mean, a new putter, I mean, to me, that's a seismic change.
Good players can make the adjustment very, very quickly.
I know, he downplayed
it. Yeah, well, and putter, you know, a putter change sometimes really does the trick. And it's just because it renews. It's a couple of things. It's a different feel, you're not doing the same thing that you were doing.
That's right.
You know, the old saying, you know, make the same mistake, and the definition of stupidity is expect a different result from the same technique. But so a new putter has a different feel, so it changes things a little bit in the terms of the mechanics. The other thing it does is that it sort of renews the enthusiasm. You know, it's like getting a new car. You know, you're excited.
That's so true. It feels good.
You know, it feels great. It looks great. And boy, you're enthused again. And that enthusiasm is really important because golf's a big game of confidence, as we know. Putter changes, but as far as getting used to it, good players can adjust very, very quickly. The biggest thing you have to adjust to is the speed. The way it comes off the face, but you know, you give a tour player 30 minutes on the green with a new putter, and he's got it dialed in already. the speed, so that's what it takes. But I'm all for it. If you start putting poorly, I'm all for a change. Find a putter that looks good, that feels good. Go out there, and you're going to get excited again, and probably start putting better.
Okay, Larry, we've only got about 30 seconds. What is the key to? You were talking about the adjustment with getting a new putter. How do you get your speed right?
Okay, the best way to work on speed is to find about a 25-footer on the putting green that's a little bit on a slope, downhill. You want to go downhill, uphill, back and forth. Mm-hmm. That's how you train yourself on speed control, distance control with a putter. So you hit that 25-footer downhill, you turn around, you hit it back to the cup, uphill, and back and forth. You keep doing that over and over. So you learn pretty quickly how to control the distance on a downhill, uphill putt. So it's the best way to do it. There's other drills for that, too. One is to lie the flag stick 2 feet behind the hole and try to roll a 25-foot putt to the hole but not into the flag stick. It's another way to work on speed control. So there's a couple of drills you can do that takes care of that.
He is simply the best, Larry Miller, as we are Inside the Ropes each and every week right here at SB Nation Radio, the next generation of sports radio. Always a true pleasure, Mr. Miller. We will talk and reconvene next week. Thank you so much.
It's always fun. Thank you.
Absolutely. Much more coming your way right here in hour number two at SB Nation Radio, the Big E Sports Show.
This is the Big E Sports Show on SB Nation Radio. Here's your host, Alyssa Walker Campbell.
Hey, Alyssa Walker Campbell, welcome back to SB Nation Radio and the Big E Sports Show on this Friday night. The fastest 2 hours in radio continues, and right now we're going to completely shift gears. We're going to take time for a book review. We are absolutely thrilled to have with us tonight New York Times bestselling author Douglas Brunt, who has just released his third novel. It is titled Trophy Son, that addresses a vitally important and timely topic, the cost of early excellence in our achievement-obsessed society. Douglas writes about the world of professional tennis and the use of performance-enhancing drugs in his latest novel and addresses a number of concerning issues. Good evening, Douglas, and congratulations on your book.
Thanks. It's great to be here with you.
Well, it is truly, I would say, a compelling read. It tells the story of tennis prodigy Anton Stratis and his isolated childhood, those grueling tennis practices, and his dysfunctional father, who is obsessed with getting him to the top of the competitive world of professional tennis. So my first question to you is, what was the inspiration behind this particular novel?
We have three kids in our family. Our oldest is seven, so he's at the cutting edge of this shift in American culture of how we're raising kids and youth athletics and early single sport specialization. So around 8, 9 years old, this phenomenon of travel sports teams and youth athletics kicks in. And I loved my own athletic experience. I know you do. And I want at least a high school athletic experience for our kids. But increasingly, that means that you've got to make a family sacrifice to lock into the youth sports culture and get on travel teams, and every weekend is 4 or 5 different soccer games. Every weekday is soccer practice. And if you feel like, I don't want to do that yet, I still want to go camping on the weekends with the family, you're making a decision about whether or not you're going to mainstream your kid, because every other kid is getting private coaching and doing all these sports skills and drills programs from the ages of 8 or 9 on. And then you worry as a parent, like, man, can I still make the basketball team in 9th grade if I haven't been doing all this since 8 years old for my kids?
You know, and Douglas, I was going to say, you know, why do you think so many parents put pressure on their kids to succeed at one particular sport? Because I bet when you and I were, you know, when I was back in school, I played multiple sports, basketball, volleyball, track, and even softball. And then ultimately, I narrowed it down to basketball because it was my best sport and I earned a full ride scholarship to Oklahoma.
And there's a time to specialize. I totally get that. And the Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hours stuff, I'm a big believer in all that stuff, mm-hmm. just not for our 8-year-olds. But it has moved earlier and earlier and earlier. And I was applying out to colleges in the 80s, so my high school athletic experience was sort of mid-80s. It's a shame that you can't play a couple of different sports. And more great athletes are speaking out about this. Steph Curry wrote a great piece a couple years ago saying that you'll be a better basketball player if you play a couple of sports. Don't just play only basketball from, you know, 5th grade on. Do a number of things, and then you'll be a better basketball player.
And we were just talking about that in hour number one. In fact, the Golden State Warriors, the NBA Finals going on, and you had just mentioned Steph Curry, his approach to, you know, youth sports and just this, what would you say, hyper-specialization, and how he himself personally benefited from playing multiple sports until he reached the collegiate level, and then ultimately, and we're talking an NBA MVP. So how soon do you think kids should be put into competitive sports? You were talking about you and your wife, Megan. You guys have 3 children. The bar is so high now as far as if you want to be competitive and you do want to succeed.
Now is a great time to be trying out lots of different things. Our kids, they do a little bit of tennis. They have this basketball class. They tried out soccer. And it sort of rotates around. You know, after 1 year, they're like, Dad, I'm sick of soccer. I want to try something else. And then they're doing flag football or something like that. And then soccer will come back around or tennis will come back around. And it's great to get that kind of exposure and learn, you know, how to use your body in different ways and just have fun and learn different stuff. But there is a time to specialize. You know, it sounds like for you it was somewhere sort of late middle school, high school, when you find the one you like.
Right,
and,
right.
You know, it's a tough balancing act for parents. I struggle with that too, because there are lots of kids who love it. There are lots of parents who love it. And we all want our kids to find something they're passionate about. It's great to see them, whether it's sports or something else, it's great to see them learn that discipline, learn that practice equals improvement, and find something that they really want to get committed to and behind. So it's a tough balancing act. But I think the way, you know, this novel has been compared to The Great Santini, which is that great Pat Conroy novel about
yes.
a basketball coach who's sort
mm-hmm.
of bullying his son player in the 70s. The difference now is it's not just a few great Santinis out there. It's like this systemic great Santini that we all need to be a part of if you want to be mainstreaming.
And we are talking with Douglas Brunt, the author of his brand new book, his novel, which is titled Trophy Son, tonight at SB Nation Radio, the Big E Sports Show. We're going to dive a little bit deeper into that. But, you know, I had just asked you about, you know, how soon should you be putting your child into competitive sports? And I have to tell you, I mean, obesity is a huge problem in our country right now. I don't want my child, you know, just necessarily sitting around, you know, eating spicy Cheetos and watching SpongeBob all day. I want them active. I want them going out there, achieving goals and setting goals.
I agree. You know, the iPad, I must confess, has been a useful tool in our house
right.
from time to time. If you need to catch a half an hour here and there, I think that can be an overused tool sometimes in a few households. And I agree, getting out and getting involved with sports, I am very pro-athletics, very pro-getting outside and running around and getting a sweat going. I just my only concern around it is early single-sport specialization. And you know, on the flip side of the obesity, there is overuse of certain limbs and joints. For example, kids who play baseball 12 months of the year at a young age, and they end up ruining their shoulder or elbow. And then, you know, one of the things in my research that I did for this novel I learned is there's a whole stream of young athletes who get injured, get corrective surgery for their injuries, and then sadly go on to be part of this opioid epidemic that our country is also facing now.
Douglas Brunt is with us at SB Nation Radio, the Big E Sports Show. We're going to talk about his new book, some more, Trophy Son. Tell us about Anton's relationship with his abusive father, the grueling training schedules, and the constant pressure of just cutthroat competition. How, you know, I have to ask you, I mean, did he truly enjoy the game? I mean, what did he endure growing up?
He had a very domineering parent, which is a common situation perhaps across all athletics, but in my research specifically on tennis, it's incredibly common. I think there is a famous biography of Andre Agassi, which explored his own father-son relationship. And what's incredible about that book is how common that is. As you go down the line of some of these top players, there's either a, you know, sort of a tiger mom behind it or a domineering father driving the intensity of the involvement in the sport at a very young age. And, you know, what 7-8-year-old is going to go spend 8 hours on the court unless the parent is driving that? And so the arc of the book, in a way, is it's really sort of a coming-of-age story about a young athlete who had this very narrow, very specialized development, both athletically and socially. I mean, he really hadn't been on a date. One of the things that's so extreme about tennis is if you're good, as opposed to soccer and lacrosse, where you finish high school and go to college, if you're really good at tennis, mm-hmm. you don't even go to your junior prom. You're pulled out, and you're at one of these tennis academies in Florida from the age of 14 or so, which was Agassi's story and Jim Courier and thousands upon thousands of young athletes who, of course, never see the top 50 in tennis. You know, the careers of tennis players sort of littered with these 19, 20-year-old kids who burn out at the end of making the very same kinds of sacrifices that the top players did, but it's lottery odds of getting to the upper echelons of tennis, and there are tens of thousands of kids who are, from the age of 14 on, making these same kinds of sacrifices.
You know, Douglas, I'm the mom of two junior golfers, 15 and 10 years old. They've had success in their sport. They have played multiple sports. And one of the biggest trends that I'm seeing right now is dads who are quitting their job, retiring early, staying home, and homeschooling their sons so they can be out on the course, getting quality time out on the course, but and then, you know, doing their schoolwork, you know, being homeschooled online.
And God bless them if that's what the kid wants and the dad's into it, the mom's into it, and they're all sort of as a family behind that and enjoying it. But I think there are a lot of people who want to be the next Tiger Woods story. And, I mean, truly, it is lottery odds. It's really hard.
Yeah.
You know, there are so many people who, even if they're peaking, 15 is not the age you want to be peaking. And there are a lot of kids who then sort of realize at the age, they get to college or so at 18, they're like, yeah, I'm having more fun doing all this stuff at the fraternity house. And they kind of give up the sports.
And so many of them burn out. Hey, we are short on time. Douglas Brunt has been with us. New York Times best-selling author. You got to go out and get a copy of this compelling read. It is titled Trophy Son. Congratulations. And best of luck to your lovely wife, Megan, this weekend on NBC. We're very excited for her.
Thanks very much. I'm hoping she gets home safely soon.
Absolutely. Much more coming your way right here at SB Nation Radio, the Big E Sports Show.
This is the Big E Sports Show on SB Nation Radio. Here's your host, Alyssa Walker Campbell.
Welcome back to SB Nation Radio and the Big E Sports Show on this Friday night. In our next segment, hey, we're going to go around the horn. We got to have some Astros talk. That's right. We're here in Houston. Very excited about the Astros. They had an incredible month of May. 22 wins. That has got to be one of the best in the history of this franchise and organization. We have extended an invitation to the Astros beat writer, one of the Big E favorites, and that is Brian McTaggart. He is going to provide some insight on, I would say, what the hottest team in the league right now. Welcome back, Brian.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, I know it was a few months ago that we had you on the program. We were talking about how the Astros, they're one of the youngest teams in Major League Baseball, very dangerous, looking to make a deep run this season. But did you think they would be this good heading, you know, here we are in the month of June?
Well, I don't think anybody could have imagined they'd be 38-16 heading into June. I mean, that's just that would be the best case scenario.
Yeah.
But I think everybody knew they were going to be good. They were going to be competitive, and the lineup was good, and it's all come together just about as well as they could have imagined. And the season is exactly one third over, so they still got a long way to go. But it certainly looks like we're in for a pretty special summer of baseball in Houston.
So when you evaluate and you step back and evaluate this one third of the season up to this point, what would you pinpoint and say this has been the key to the Astros' early and often success?
Well, I think number one, and this, I think we talked about this before the season, was Keuchel and the colors are healthy, and they weren't healthy last year.
That's
and,
right.
And that, yeah, that's one of the reasons they did so poorly. But they're both healthy and pitching great. I mean, Keuchel's unbeaten. McCullers had a tremendous month of May, an ERA of under one. So when you have your top two guys in the rotation going out there and you're winning almost every one of their starts, that's pretty good. And then, of course, the lineup. We knew the lineup was going to be deep, but it is a pretty relentless lineup. 1-9, they don't stop. When you have Alex Bregman hitting ninth, that's pretty darn good because he's got a chance to be a special player. So, it's just the lineup depth and the health of the top two guys in the pitching rotation that really those are really the keys. But if you ask me one, it was definitely Keuchel and McCullers healthy and pitching well.
Any concern in terms of with the rotation and depth? Because what I understand, there's been some injuries that have taken place.
Yeah, there's no doubt they are having some depth concerns. Charlie Morton is on the DL and looks like he's out indefinitely with a lat strain. Those injuries can take quite a while. We know Colin McHugh has been hurt all year. He's working his way back, but very slowly. And now they had another DL stint just a couple of days ago. Joe Musgrove put on the DL with some shoulder discomfort, I guess is what they're calling it. So, and he was coming off his best start of the season. So now you have guys like David Polino and Brett Peacock in the rotation, and you know not what you would have imagined. And Peacock has pitched pretty well, but they need to get some of these guys healthy. The trade deadline's coming up in a couple of months, and I think they're going to be very active to try to get another arm. I think they would have done that anyway, but especially now with the injuries that they have, they could use another arm to bolster that depth.
The Houston Astros beat writer Brian McTaggart is back with us at SB Nation Radio, the Big E Sports Show. Give Brian a follow on Twitter, at Brian McTaggart. And, you know, Brian, since you're on the show, you know, my family and I, we were out there at the ballpark on Memorial Day weekend and had the opportunity. This is really my first time to be out there this season, you know, with that wonderful win against the Baltimore Orioles. And the one thing that I took away from watching them is they can light it up in a hurry. They can score a lot of runs very, very fast, very entertaining. But offensively, man, they've got some power at the plate.
Oh, yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, in April, they were scoring some runs and they were winning games, but it felt like they were missing another gear in offense. And in May, they really kicked it in. They averaged 6.2 runs a game in May, which is pretty unbelievable. And not only Baltimore, but then they go to Minneapolis and they score 40 runs in three games. And they hit six home runs in the last game of that series.
Right.
So it's not even about six home runs. They had that 11-run inning in the first game in Minnesota, and they did it with only two extra base hits, and they didn't get a home run to the last part of that inning. I mean, they had singles. They were moving runners, hitting balls in gaps so that they can beat you in so many ways, and then someone comes up with a big swing and knocks a ball out of the ballpark, whether it's Beltran, Marisnik, Correa, Altuve, go on and on and on. They just have so much firepower up and down the lineup. It's very, very hard to stop.
Well, the Astros, 11 runs in the eighth inning, as you were talking about, against the Twins and on the road. And that tells me this is a team that has tremendous resiliency. They're down, but they are never out.
No, never out. I mean, they were down in that game 8-2.
That's
right. It's the first time in their history they were down by six runs in the seventh inning or later and came back to, or eighth inning later and came back to win. They've also won three games this year down 5-0 and come back to win those. And when teams are doing stuff like that, that's a special team. So even if they fall behind 3-0, no problem. I mean, they lead the majors with 20. And, you know, I've watched baseball a long time, and teams that consistently win when they fall behind and have come from behind wins, those are normally the teams that are really in store for some special things and usually make the playoffs and are resilient, like you said, and usually can take that resiliency late into October in a playoff run.
In your mind, is this baseball's best team right now?
Oh, yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, they're 3 or 4 games from anybody else as far as best record. You know, the Nationals are really good. They're going to be heard from. I think teams like the Indians and the Yankees are going to get better as the season goes along. But Astros are by far, I think, the class of the American League at this point. They lead the division by 11 games. You know, they still have to, you know, hold up. I think the Rangers are going to play a little bit better, and the division's really down. So they're going to have to keep beating up on their division teams, and then they could have a huge lead at the All-Star break. But they are the best team. They just have to find a way to keep these guys healthy, because, like I said, they still have 108 games left to play. Long way.
That is a long ways, and it's a beautiful mixture of veterans and young players. And I think what's exciting too, Brian, is just you're seeing how they're meshing. They've grown, they're maturing, and really coming together as a team and playing some great baseball. And being here in Houston, it is a lot of fun to watch. Always a true pleasure to have with us Brian McTaggart, the Houston Astros beat writer. Hey, you have got to give him a follow at Twitter at Brian McTaggart, and also go out and get a copy of his new book, 100 Things Astro Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. We'll talk soon. Thank you, Brian.
All right. Thanks for having me on.
And a very special thank you to all of our amazing guests and our lineup tonight at SB Nation Radio. We'll see you next weekend for the biggest, the best in sports, the Big E Sports Show. Don't drink and drive.